Take it away, Harry.
Thank you very much for the kind words and the warm introduction. And thanks for the opportunity. I wish it was in person, and hopefully we will all come out of this, and life will be back to normal, but hopefully we won't go back to normal. Hopefully we will have bettered ourselves while in isolation during these difficult times. I wanted to talk about a particular scene in the Torah. There's usually one of two things, maybe simultaneously, going on in any Torah passage. Either you have a law. If it's a law, I wouldn't ask you, what do you think God is trying to teach us with this law? If God says, don't murder, I wouldn't say, what do you think he's trying to teach us? You'd say, he's teaching us, don't murder. But if it's a story, it's a little trickier. If it's a story, he's also teaching us something. Sometimes we forget that. If it's a story, it's a lesson. There's a reason why there are more stories written about, for example, Abraham than about Isaac, and about Jacob than about Isaac. It's not because Isaac, Yitzchak, was less important a patriarch than his father or than his son. It's just that when God was curating the stories, sharing with us some aspects or some events that happened in their lives, he was very carefully choosing them in order to teach us lessons. So you know one thing, if God chose to include a story in the Torah, he did it because we're meant to learn at least one lesson. And sometimes it's obvious. If I'd say to you, why do you think God included that story of Abraham, binding his son, Kedas Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, you might say, well, it's teaching us that when God says to do something, even if it doesn't make sense, you do it. You'd be right. Or you might say, it's teaching us that we have to be willing to sacrifice anything for God. And you'd be right. But there could be other lessons. But it's obvious. That iconic story is there to teach us a lesson or multiple lessons. So there is a story that many of us, most of us, maybe all of us, but maybe not, are familiar with. But it happens so quickly, and it's such a weird story that if I stopped you and said, what do you think the lesson is there? It might not be so clear. And if I stopped you and said, can you explain the story? You'd stop and think about it. You realize this is really weird. So I want to tell you the story. I'm not going to adorn it at all. I'm just going to read you the passages. I'll add one Rashi, one comment from Rashi as we go on. And then we'll start teasing out the lessons. So to pick up the story, to tell you where we are, Abraham is in his tent. Abraham is in his tent, and he has just had his bris. He's been circumcised at the age of 99. Ouch. He is suffering. But of course, since he's Abraham, the ultimate Baal Chesed, you look up the word kindness in dictionary, and you see his smiling, beatific face, he's looking for guests. And so God sends him guests. The guests aren't regular guests, though. They're angels pretending to be men, and he invites them into his tent and asks Sarah to prepare some food. And so Abram's in the tent. Sarah, his wife, is outside the tent, and the angels each have a different mission. And one of them has a mission to tell Abraham the beautiful prophecy, the news, that next year at this time, he and Sarah are going to have a son. Now, that's a big deal. Anytime anybody has a child, it's a big deal. But when you're 99 and your wife is 89, and at the age of 190 for her, you're going to have a child, that's a really, really big deal. Any child, let alone when the child's going to be Isaac, is going to be Yitzchak. So I want to pick up the story, so here we are. So the angel gives the news to Abraham, and so the Torah tells us, your wife will have a son. So that's the prophecy that they're told. And then the Torah tells us, Sarah was listening at the door of the tent that was behind him. Now, she's not eavesdropping. She's back and forth. She's bringing in the food. The angel gives the news while she's within earshot. So she overhears this news that she, 89-year-old woman, is going to have a son the next year. So we're told that the Torah then tells us, Abraham and Sarah were old, well on in years. Sarah no longer had the way of women. So the Torah is telling us that anatomically, it was impossible, biologically, she could not have children. So this is going to happen. This is going to be a miracle. Torah continues. Sarah laughed to herself, saying, now that I am worn out, shall I have the pleasure of a son? My husband also being an old man. So she laughs and explains her laugh. She says, it's not possible. I'm too old. It's not possible. And he's too old. Next passage. God says to Abraham. So now God obviously appears on the scene after Sarah laughs. And he says to Abram, quote, why did Sarah laugh saying, can I really give birth when I am old? Now, this is the one time I'm going to interject one comment. Rashi, the greatest of the biblical commentators, writing in Troyes, France in the 1000s, Jewish population, maybe 100, in his masterpiece, his magnum opus, his commentary on the Torah, he points out that he notices the difference, that when Sarah left, she said, am I really going to have a son when I'm old and my husband's old? But when God quoted her, he quoted her as only having said, I'm old. He left out that extra little piece where she mentioned that Abraham's old. So Rashi says that scripture, meaning the Torah, altered the what she actually said for the sake of peace, because she had also said, and my husband is old. So we see here that God kind of, as a lawyer, we would call it, he ellipsized, he truncated it, he cut it off. He only quoted half of her statement, not the whole statement. So God then continues in his statement to Abraham. Is there anything too far removed from God? At the appointed time, I will return to you at this time of life, and Sarah will have a son. Now, in between this passage and the next one, apparently, according to most commentators, Abraham approaches Sarah and asks her, did you hear something and laugh about it? To which she responds, this is the next passage, Sarah denied it, saying, I did not laugh, because she was afraid. And then the next passage, this is what finishes our story. This is the whole story. He said, presumably Abraham is responding to her, not so, for you did laugh. So now, if you're keeping track at home, I want to go through the lessons that we are learning from this story. I think they're obvious, but in case they're not, let's keep track of them. Lesson number one, if you are starting a fight between two people by telling one person what another person did or said, don't start World War II. You know, tell them just enough to get them upset. You don't have to tell them everything. Here, God's starting the fight. He could have started a bigger fight and quoted Sarah completely about how she's also said her husband's old. It was enough to just start a little fight. We had a situation a number of years ago, my wife and I, where someone got a hold of our credit card, and I got a bill when I got the monthly bill, and I found out that we had bought like $2,000 worth of equipment from a tractor supply company in Kentucky. So I was pretty sure, you know, even I had to go through the motions of asking my wife, like, you didn't buy any tractor supply equipment in Kentucky. She said, what are you talking about? So somebody had gotten access to our credit card and billed it. So I called the credit card company and they reversed the charge. Obviously somebody had done, they sent us, they stopped our card and they sent us a new card. So I said to them, you know, it's such a weird thing. Like, wouldn't there be some bells or whistles that would go off? Like, it's such a weird purchase for me. So they said, actually, you know what we can do? What we could do going forward is we could put an alert. So if you spend over whatever the amount is, like over, I think it's over $500, you'll automatically get an email when it goes through. So if you receive that and it's not something that you spent, then call us right away. I said, great, you know, put it on the card. So ever since then, what'll happen is I'll come home from work and I'll say to my wife, you know, this will happen, you know, once in a while, teasingly, I'll say, you know, how was your day? It was great. I'll say, how was Bloomingdale's? And it drives her crazy. Because if she puts a purchase over whatever it is, like $500 a card, I get an email about it. So that's our lesson number one, right? That when you're going to start a fight, it's okay. You can start a little fight. Don't start the full fight. That's one. Lesson number two that we get from Sarah Imenu, from Sarah the matriarch, if you're scared, it's okay to lie. And we see straight out, the Torah tells us, she was afraid, and so she lied. She said, I didn't laugh. And a blatant lie. The Torah tells us she laughed, but she says, I didn't laugh because she was afraid. And then the third lesson, and this one's the most important for the guys out there. This is my favorite one. It has a lot of resonance with me. When you're in a fight with anybody, but particularly when you're in a fight with your wife, an argument, you get the last word in because you see what Abraham did there. She said, I didn't laugh. And he said, no, you did. That's right, big guy. You get that last word in. Now, if you haven't realized by now, I am kidding about all three of these lessons. They are ridiculous, and there is no way the Torah is telling us the story to teach us any one of those lessons. And if you were Peter Parker, if you were Spider-Man, your spider sense would have been tingling right away, even listening to the story, because not only are those ridiculous lessons, but every actor in the story is acting against type. God doesn't start fights, let alone in that most sacred of relationships, starting a fight between a husband and wife. God, what is the world is going on? If you have a problem with Sarah, you're upset that Sarah left, go appear to Sarah. Why are you telling Abraham something? Very strange. Sarah lies because she's scared. What's she scared of? She's scared of her husband. We've seen previously, when she has something to tell her husband, she tells him. When it came time to kick Hagar and Yishmael out of the house, not easy. Avram did not want to kick them out. God had to appear to him and say, yeah, you got to listen to her. She didn't back down. All of a sudden now she's scared to admit that she left. What is she scared of? Yes, Abraham, I laughed when that guy sitting in your tent told you I'm going to have a kid, you know, at the age of 90. Please, yes, I laughed. Okay, you happy? What is she scared of? And the third one, Abraham getting the last word in? That's not Abraham. Abraham is the guy who campaigned to try to save the people of Sodom. God, how can you kill them? What if I could find 50 people, 45, 40? Would you take 30? How about 20, 10? And he's got to get that last word in. So this can't possibly be the lessons. So many years ago, when I was going through this passage and realized just how crazy it is, I was struggling with this because I know there's something going on here, and I know that the Torah is trying to teach us a lesson, and I doubt, you could try to convince me that the lesson is, well, even Sarah, even though she's a matriarch, she's only human, it was a moment of weakness in her faith. I'm not buying that. I think something else is going on. So there are some commentators that say, there's one line of commentators, the women are not going to like this, and I'm with you on this, I don't like it either, that say, well, it would have been immodest for God to speak to Sarah. So that's why he spoke to Abraham. I don't get that at all. We know that Sarah was a prophetess. We know that God spoke to Miriam in another instance. I don't see how that it would have been an impediment. So one other possibility that I toyed with is that we're learning here that everything God creates is important, including yentas. We know what yentas are. I don't have to define that. So I'll tell you a story what I mean. When I came out of law school, I went into big firm practice. And then in my third year, my father convinced me to join the family business. At the time, it was my father and my mother, and I was the third family member. Since then, my next younger sister, next younger brother, next younger sister, next younger brother, and next younger sister all joined. So there are seven children, seven out of eight. We had a little bit of attrition. The youngest is a nurse practitioner. Seven out of eight working as lawyers in the same firm with both of our parents. So in the New York office, there are four brothers. It's me and then it's three younger brothers. So we were moving offices in our building. You can stop by and visit, although, you know, if you make it a social call, nobody should get hurt. Usually when somebody's visiting, it's because they got hurt. We were moving from the 11th floor to the 44th floor, moving on up in the world. So in order to do that, you had to throw out some old stuff and pack up. And so we spent the better part of a week throwing out and packing up and moving the stuff upstairs. So my father happened to visit during one of the days that we were packing up for the move. And he spent the day, and then he went back to Philadelphia. And later, at the end of the day, after he left, he called me. I was still in the office. And he said, you know, I forgot to tell you something. When I was at the Mincha Minyan, we host the Mincha Minyan every day at 4, or at least we did. We haven't gotten back to it yet because of COVID. Hopefully we will again soon. He said, when I was at the Mincha Minyan, one of the guys came up to me, and he said, you know, you're moving, right? He said, yeah. He said, well, why are your sons throwing out your stuff? I was like, well, what are you talking about? My sons aren't throwing out. He said, yeah, I think your sons are throwing out your stuff. So my father said to me, you're not throwing out my things, are you? Because my father had certain things that were New York specific. For example, he had gotten honored by certain entities in New York. He had some New York diplomas. Those were in his New York office rather than his Philadelphia office. So of course we weren't throwing them away. We were moving them up to the other floor. So I said to my father, Dad, of course we're not. It's ridiculous. Of course we're not throwing away your stuff. So I hung up the phone. I said to myself, you know what? I better go check. So I went into the freight elevator room. We were stacking everything to be thrown away. Thank God we were only stacking it there and it wasn't thrown away. And I see in one of the areas my father's pictures and diplomas in the stack to be thrown out. So I went crazy. I took them out. Obviously, I took them all out. I brought them back in the office. And I called our filing clerk and I said, what in the world? You have my father's stuff. You were throwing away stuff. He says, oh, you know what? I had my nephew and he was helping us out, you know, he must have gotten confused. I told him one pile, it was the next pile. So he must have thrown out the wrong pile. I'm like, thank God that guy told my father. Now realize, the guy who told my father is a guy in New York with whom I pray every day for years and years and years. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. He's a friend of mine. Why in the world did he go over to my father instead of coming over to me and saying, Harry, I think you made a mistake. I saw in the freight elevator room you got your dad's stuff in there. It's got to be a mistake. Why did he go to my dad? And the answer, of course, is that to come to me, that's not fun. To go to my dad and say, you know, your boys are throwing your stuff out. That's a lot of fun, right? So maybe what's going on here is you're seeing the story. You know what? You know, that's why God created yentas. Because somebody can tell you something that if it wasn't fun, you know, they wouldn't otherwise tell you. Like if God didn't tell this to Abraham, he wouldn't otherwise have known it. I don't think that's what's going on either. So I want to suggest a reason. And in suggesting that reason, I want to try to tease out what I think the real lessons are. So I think that it's possible that the reason that God went to Abraham and not to Sarah is that God blamed Abraham for Sarah's laughter. God's saying to Abraham the following: is there anything too far removed from me? It's a very weird question to ask Abraham. Abraham's the first monotheist. He's the first person to realize since way back when, for those who communicated directly with God, that God runs the world and is responsible for everything in it. What kind of a question is that to ask? Imagine asking Abraham, right? Imagine asking, you know, some great sage today, you go up to some great rabbi, you think there's anything God can't do? What kind of ridiculous question? Of course the answer is yes. So God may be suggesting to Abraham, why in the world would Sarah laugh? So what I want to suggest is this. Maybe Abraham and Sarah had a different view at that time with respect to how God runs the world. Abraham knows that when God runs the world, he can do anything. And there are times he will do anything. There are limits on what he will do. So, for example, if he decides he's going to do a miracle, he may do a worldwide miracle. Creation, the flood, the dispersion. Or he may do an individual miracle, an open individual miracle. Let's call it a nes nigla prati, a specific open miracle for an individual. He's willing to subvert nature for one person or for one couple. Sarah may disagree. Of course, God can do anything, but that's not the way he interacts with the world. If he's going to do an open miracle, subverting the laws of nature that he put in place, that's a worldwide phenomenon. That is the flood, that's the dispersion, that's creation. He's not going to take a woman who physically, anatomically is not capable of having a child and have her have a child at the age of 9. That would be an open miracle for an individual. It doesn't work that way. Not that he can't. Of course he can. But it's just not the way he runs the world. So maybe God is saying to Abraham the following. Abraham, Sarah just laughed when she heard the news. Is there anything that I can't do? You know that I am even willing to do a miracle for an individual. But apparently, she doesn't know that. Abraham, my dear friend, is there a story that you never told her? Maybe now is the time to tell her the story. Now, why would Abraham know with certainty that God would do an individual, a specific miracle, an open miracle for an individual, and Sarah might not know that? We know why. Because when Abraham was a young boy, he was the first iconoclast. He was the first idol breaker. His father put him in charge one day. His father was an idol maker. So his father put him in charge, gave him the keys to the garage or the shed, wherever he made the idols. He said, Abe, you know, keep an eye on them. His father comes home that day, and the idols were all destroyed. He says, Abraham, what in the world happened to the idols? And Abraham says, Dad, can't imagine. It was a huge fight. Like first the two smaller ones got into a fight, and the bigger ones smashed them, and then they smashed each other. They destroyed each other. His father said to him, Abraham, idols don't have any power. They can't get into a fight. This is ridiculous. You obviously did it. And Abraham said to his father and dad, respectfully, if they don't have any power, why do you worship them? So his father took him by the scruff of his neck to Nimrod, the king, and he said to Nimrod, listen, I got this little kid here, and he doesn't believe in our gods. He believes in one God above. He doesn't believe in our idols. So Nimrod said, yeah, you don't believe in our idols? All right, let's see how powerful your God is. And he forced Abraham to walk through a furnace. He's a little kid. And he makes like 12 years old or so, the commentators say. So he makes him walk through a furnace. And Abraham walks through the furnace and comes out unscathed on the other side. That is an open miracle. That is subverting the laws of nature. There is no way Harry Houdini cannot walk through a burning furnace and walk through unscathed and unburned. So Abraham had been the beneficiary himself of an open miracle for an individual. So maybe God is saying to Abraham, maybe it's time that you told Sarah that story, that I will do miracles for individuals and I'm going to do one for her. And so that's when Abraham goes in the next passage and says to her off screen, Sarah, did you just hear something and did you laugh? And the Torah tells us that she denied it because she was afraid. Now, as a lawyer, I can tell you there are 100 different ways to deny something. There are practically unlimited ways that the defendant in one of my cases can deny responsibility after being coached up by his lawyer. All sorts of ways. You can have emphatic denials and sort of kind of denials. So maybe her denial was not an emphatic denial. What are you talking about, Abraham? I didn't laugh. Maybe it was a soft denial. Me? Laugh because she's afraid. What's she afraid of? Every husband and wife know that there are certain no-fly zones. There are certain things you don't bring up. They're just too painful. You don't bring them up. You don't make a joke like, Abraham, don't play around with this. Please don't tease me. yes, I overheard the guy saying I'm going to have a son. You know, and I know, we prayed and prayed and prayed for decades. We prayed when I was in my 20s and in my 30s and in my 40s and in my 50s. But now I'm 89. It's no longer possible. I'm scared to even have this conversation. Don't play games with me. So it's a soft denial because she's afraid, because this is just, you don't bring this up to a woman who spent so many decades praying and now it's obviously too late. And Avram says to her, not because he's getting the last word in, this isn't a fight between the patriarch and the matriarch. This is an incredibly tender, loving moment. He says to her, Sarah, you did laugh and I want you to sit down, because there's a story that I never told you before. And I'm going to tell you the story of how God once did an open miracle for me, and now he's going to do an open miracle for us. And next year, we are going to be holding the sun. And he sits her down, and he tells her the story of the Kivshana Esh, the furnace that he walked through. And sure enough, the next year, they're holding the sun. Now, you may say to me, to Mr. Miracle. I mean, come on. Even not in a bragging way, you'd think that Avram would have told her the story just of, by the way, I want to just point out to you, you may not realize, you know, the level of what Hashem's willing to do for someone who believes in him. How did you not tell her? It's just an all-time great story. My wife has heard all of my all-time great stories. How would he not have shared that with her? And the answer I want to suggest is that the whole story is the following. After Avraham, when Avram was brought along to Nimrod, he was brought along with his other brothers. He had one brother, Nachar, who was an idolater. From early to late, throughout his life, he was an idolater. He had another brother, a younger brother, his name was Haran. So Nimrod also asked Haran, whose God do you believe in? Do you believe in our gods, or do you believe in Avram's God? And Haran hesitated. He waited until Avram walked through the furnace, and then he said, I believe in Avram's gods, in Avram's God. So Nimrod said, okay, in that case, you're next. So he sent Haran to the furnace, and Haran was burned alive. Now, Haran died absolutely as a Kiddush Hashem. Nimrod said, whose God do you believe in? He said, Avraham's God, 100% Kiddush Hashem. But I suppose he wasn't on the same level of Avraham in that he waited. He didn't say it right away. He waited, hedged his bets until Avraham came through. So he didn't merit that open miracle. Haran was not just Avraham's father. Haran was not just Avraham's brother. Haran was also Sarah's father. Remember, Avram married his niece. Sarah was 2 at the time, according to the commentators. Too young to really have known what was going on. So I can easily imagine Avram not wanting to tell Sarah that story, because it's difficult to tell her the whole story, even without explaining it. I made it. Your father didn't. I guess I was on a higher level. And I'm sure he was on a very high level, too. Psychologically, it would have been very difficult. So he may have just told all of his servants, if it ever comes up, you just tell Sarah. He may have told her, your father died. Ask Kiddush Hashem. And that's it. And don't tell the rest of the story. So now you'll say to me, what about the rest of the world? They could have just, you know, clicked it in. They could have just done a Google search, you know, Abraham and then Nimrod and Kivshana Esh. Why didn't they come up? That's an easy answer. One thing I can assure you is that when Nimrod was shown up by this kid, I guarantee you that he sent the message out. Everybody here, you may think you just saw something, but I'm telling you right now, if I hear hide or hair of this story from anybody, you reporter from Al Jazeera, and you from the New York Times, and you from the Journal, and you from the Post, and you from the whatever, I will start off cutting off your fingers, then I'll go to your toes, and I'll work my way up from there. Nobody is publishing this story, because it would have been a terrible blow to his covet. He is the king, and so that I'm confident in saying that whatever word would get out, it wasn't going to get out through Nimrod. So it couldn't very well be. And Nimrod was able to put a complete blanket on that information getting out from his end. And Avraham, in sensitivity to Sarah's feelings, may have decided that it was wiser not to share the story with her. And that may be why Avraham is approached by God and not Sarah, because it's not Sarah's problem. Sarah doesn't believe in Hashem. Of course Hashem can do that. Her understanding of the way he interacts with the world is that that's not the way he interacts with the world. Avraham knows differently. And so maybe Hashem is just tipping him off. It's time to go tell her that story. And so now that we have, if I'm right, we have a better understanding of what's going on. So now we can try to tease out some real lessons in that story. So lesson number one, I'll do the first two quickly, and then we'll get to the third one, which is the main one for the topic of this talk. Lesson number one is that we have to be very, very careful when we reply, especially when replying in anger. It's very interesting. When we do something wrong, right, and we hurt somebody's feelings. We insult somebody. We overlook something. We forget something. We have every excuse known to man. And we generally are genuinely are horrified. We feel terrible. And we explain it. I'm so sorry. I fill in the blanks, whatever it is. I was tired that day. I was sick that day. I was distracted. I was this. I was that. I was this. Like, and we really have excuses. And we want our excuses to be accepted. But when it's somebody else, that was unforgivable. You say, but what do you mean? Give the guy a break. Maybe no, he definitely realized. No, she meant it. No, she, like, hello. When you're in a similar situation and you wrong someone, you have every excuse, real excuses. I don't mean made up excuses. Like, there's a reason. You feel horrible. Well, they do also. So just give them the same understanding that you're expecting back. And I say this to people all the time, is that there, you cannot imagine the level of power that you have when you've been wronged. When you have been wronged and you are able to forgive it, you can stand on Yom Kippur. Remember what happened to the Jewish people? We were done. At the time of the destruction of the temple, we were done. And Yirmiyahu, the prophet, is like, however he did this, he was waking up the patriarchs and matriarchs, right? He's waking up, Abraham, pray to God. Nope, not accepting it. Sarah, pray to God. Nope. Yitzchak, nope. Rivka, nope. Yaakov, nope. Leah, nope. Rachel says to God, God, I'm just flesh and blood. And when my sister was going to be embarrassed because my father was doing the old switcheroo, I gave her the secret signs that my husband, my fiance, had given me so that my sister wouldn't be embarrassed, okay? So I wasn't jealous of her. I'm begging you. I know the Jewish people, they worshiped other gods. They strayed from you, but just don't be, you're God. If I could forgive and I wasn't jealous, don't be jealous and forgive them. And God says to her, you just saved the Jewish people. So if you could stand on Yom Kippur, it's coming up soon, and somebody wronged you in the past year and say, God, you know what that person did, and you know that they were wrong, and it was outrageous, and you know how hurtful it was, you know how insulted I was, you know how embarrassed I was, you know how mortified I was, I am forgiving them. And I'm asking you, please forgive me the infractions, you know, of the past year. You're in fuego. You can't imagine how powerful that is upstairs. So that's lesson one. Lesson two is that we really have to consider the feelings of others. I had this incredibly heartwarming story for me. I'll share it with you. My oldest son lives with his family in Israel, and at the time, this is going back a little over a year ago, year and a half ago. My son had a second child. He had a son, then he had a daughter, and so my second son was also in Israel at the time. So he calls my second son. He tells him, "Listen, I'm naming the baby tomorrow in shul." Okay, so of course he's going to, my second son's now back as of last week, but at the time they lived about a 20-minute walk away from each other. So right away, my second son said to himself, oh no, he asks, which minyan are you going to? So my oldest son davens Nates. So he says, yeah, listen, I understand if you can't make it, you know, I go to a, you know, a 4:45 a.m. minyan, okay? So my second son said, yeah, absolutely, I'll be there, okay? Sits his alarm for like 4 a.m., and he's got a baby at the time. His baby's up in the middle of the night, and he just sleeps clear through the alarm, absolutely clear through the alarm. And he is so horrified the whole shop. He's like, I can't believe it. Who else is going to be there? He's got one relative there in Israel. He calls me up. He asked me to be there for the naming. You know, my parents couldn't make it in time. The baby was born right before Shabbos. I cannot. And the whole Shabbos, he's killing himself. I can't believe that I didn't make it. In the meantime, Friday night before they went to sleep, my older son and his wife decide, you know what? We're still not sure about the name, but we're going to name tomorrow. I mean, I told my brother we're going to name tomorrow, but they just weren't 100% sure. So they said, you know what? We got to wait. We got to wait until we're sure. So my older son says, he's going to kill me. I mean, he's going to kill me. He's going to get up at 4 in the morning and walk over. He usually goes to like an 8 o'clock minyan. He's going to get up at 4 and walk 20 minutes. I'm not going to do this. He's going to kill me. So he said he spent the whole minyan like this, like turned around, like he's looking at the entrance, back to the front of the room, back at the entrance, waiting so he could apologize to his brother. And he says, finally, by the time they got to laning, he said, you know what? I don't think he's going to come. I think I'm okay. So he spent the whole davening terrified that his younger brother's going to be so upset at him. And the younger brother spent the whole Shabbos like so upset. I can't believe I insulted the feelings. And to me, it's a heartwarming story because you have two brothers like so worried about hurting the feelings of others. I'll tell you another story on the same issue. Last year, February of 2018, just going back a couple of years, Rav Pesach Krohn was in Pesach, and he was speaking for an organization. They were doing a parlor meeting, like a brunch meeting. So he had brunch, and then he did he gave a beautiful shear, and then they collected money for this organization. So he gave his usual, typically fantastic shear. At the end of the shear, completely out of nowhere, total non sequitur, he's going, by the way, I know what tonight is. I know it's Super Bowl Sunday. Nobody has to waste any time watching the game. The Patriots are going to win 57-3. So my head like snapped back. Why? Because the Patriots were playing my beloved Philadelphia Eagles. I'm from Philly. And at 57-3. So I waited till the crowd thinned out. I went over. I introduced myself to him. He said, oh, I know your father from Philadelphia. I said, Ricardo, I want to apologize that I had that reaction. I said, but you know, I'm from Philadelphia. I'm an Eagles fan. 57-3. He said, look, I don't follow so closely, but I heard that the Eagles, their quarterback is injured. They have a backup quarterback. They're playing the Patriots who win every year. Like, I don't really think they have much of a chance, right? I said, look, I get that. I understand the Eagles may lose, but 57-3, that's a slaughter. You could give them a puncher's chance, you know, I don't know, 27-10, something like that. He's like, who knows? You know, we'll see what'll happen. Later that night, the Eagles, against all odds, win the Super Bowl. I get to cross that off my bucket list, my life bucket list. I'm not greedy. I just wanted one win. We got it. Finally, we got a Super Bowl trophy. I can shut up all my, you know, my friends who live in the area who are Giants fans who are always making fun of the Eagles. We finally got it. The next morning, I get a text on my phone. Hi, Harry. Just wanted to apologize again. I guess I spoke too soon. Congratulations on the victory. Pesach Chrome. I couldn't believe he tracked down my cell phone number to apologize again. I was kidding around. I wasn't really offended. Rabbit Chrome, he's not really predicted, okay? Track down my cell phone number to apologize lest he insulted me through his prediction that my team was going to lose. That's how careful you have to be about people's feelings. And now let's get to the main lesson that I want to draw from the story, which is that do we believe that God does individual miracles? Do we believe in our heart of hearts? We know, yes, creation and the flood and the dispersion and COVID-19, but is God, the way he interacts with the world, does that include a willingness to do an individual miracle, a miracle for me? We say it every day when we thank him in the prayers. We say every day, we thank him for Al Nisecha Shebechol Yom. We thank him all every day for all the miracles he does every day. But we just referring to those general miracles of the earth rotating, revolving, or do we believe that he does miracles for us? So I want to share with you one of the most powerful words of Torah that I ever heard, explanations of a Torah passage, as follows. We are taught the Shemitah laws. God tells the Jews, you're going to go into the Holy Land, and for 6 days you have to let the land, you should work the land. He says you should plant and you should reap and eat until you're satisfied, and then he says, and if you'll ask, what will I eat during the seventh year? Why would you ask that? Because the seventh year is a Shemitah year. The seventh year you're not allowed to plant. So God says, and if you ask, what will I eat during the seventh year? God says, don't worry, because I am going to give a triple blessing to the sixth year. In the sixth year, you're going to have enough. When you plant for that sixth year, you're going to have enough for the sixth year and the seventh year, and even into the eighth year until you're able to plant and harvest for that eighth year. It's going to be a triple bounty in that sixth year. Great. Okay. So Rabbi Yashiv asks the following question. He says, when were the Jews going to ask that question? What will I eat during the seventh year? He says, they may not have asked it in the desert, but when they get into Israel, then they're going to ask it. He says, you think they're going to wait until the seventh year to ask that, like the eve of the seventh year? Hey, by the way, what am I going to eat next year? You know, me, my wife, my kids, my grandkids, what are we going to eat? Of course, they're not going to wait that long. They're going to ask that from the moment they get there. As soon as those laws go into effect, that 6 years planting, 1 year fallow, they're going to start asking, by the way, what are we going to eat in that seventh year? And they'll probably be asking even more often as they get closer to that seventh year. So he says, okay, so let's think about it. They're going to ask the question, and God has reassured them in the Torah, got nothing to worry about. I got this. Sixth year, triple blessing. So now what's going to happen? Sixth year is going to come around, and God's going to give the triple blessing. Now, let's think about who's going to get the triple blessing. Everybody's going to get the triple blessing. God said, I'm going to give you a triple blessing. He says, so you have different people of different levels of belief, right? The people that absolutely believe in God, they would have spent those 6 years eating till they're satisfied, like God predicted, and then they trust God. They're going to have that bounty. But you're going to have some people that may have hedged their bets and said, you know what? listen, of course I believe in God, but you know, just between me, you, and the wall, you never know. You never know. It can't hurt to save for a rainy day. So they pretend to be Joseph in Egypt, and you squirrel a little way in the silo in the barn, you know, wherever you keep extra grain, just in case, a little bit of a reservoir. He says, so fine. So, but now even those people that squirreled away, they get the triple blessing. So that's it. The next time around, they're going to know, ah, you see, I didn't need to squirrel anything away. You know, God came through. He says, you think that God put that question in the Torah because it was going to be asked one time in history? One time during those first 6 years, people are going to ask that, and then never again? He says, that's not how it worked. He says, you know what happened? That first 6th year came, and guess what? When God said you're going to go into the land, and you're going to plant for 6 years, and you're going to eat till you're satisfied, that wasn't a prediction. That was a command. God was saying, when you go into that land, I want you to plant, and I want you to eat until you're satisfied for 6 years. I will know the difference. If you're dieting, that's fine. I'm not asking you to overeat. But if you're squirreling away food in a reservoir because you don't trust me, guess what? When that 6th year comes, I'm not making a miracle for you. You've shown me that you don't trust me. If you don't trust me, you're on your own. You don't get an open miracle, a triple bounty in the 6th year if you've shown me that you don't trust me. So the people that squirreled away food didn't get that extra blessing. So guess what they're going to ask the next round? What am I going to eat the 7th year? And this time they're going to say, good thing I squirreled away some food the last time. You know, otherwise I wouldn't have had what to eat. And they'll do the same thing again. Unless they could snap out of them and say, you know what, this time let me trust God because I saw that my neighbor, you know, did get that triple blessing. And so you'll say to yourselves, okay, that's interesting. That was back then. But what about now? And the answer is, what about now? What about now is we are heading up to real soon. It's around the corner. You're going to blink. You're going to be standing in, you know, wherever we're going to be standing, indoor minion, outdoor minion, with a mask, without a mask, whatever. We're all trying to figure that out together. But wherever we're going to be going, you know, whether you're in a minion, with a mask or without, or on your own, I hope that everybody's going to be reciting the Rosh Hashanah prayers. And we know that everyone gets judged on Rosh Hashanah, and your income for the following year is determined. There's a number put next to your name, Harry Rothenberg. Please, God, let it be enough that I can continue to support my family and support Torah causes and help the poor, etc. And may it be I'm going to, and the more you give me, the more I'll give away. You know, you want a nice number. Whatever that number is, God writes a number next to your name, right? Now, do you think that when God writes the number next to your name, he's saying as follows, listen, I'm putting a number next to your name, but you got to help me out here. I mean, you got to be a player, right? Like the only way you're getting that number is, you got to cheat your customers a little. I'm not saying enough to go to jail, but you know, you can cut corners a little bit. I mean, come on, you got to work with me, right? And when you do your taxes, you know, you can fudge it a little bit, you know, save a few bucks here and there. And okay, so it's not, you know, fully on the up and up. It doesn't have to be glot kosher. It can be kosher style on your taxes. You honestly think that's what God's telling you? Of course not. He's saying this is the number you're going to get if you're honest. If you're honest in business and you don't cheat on your taxes, this is the number you're going to get. Now, the sages say, if you play around and you cheat, you can increase that number, but you have one guarantee, you will lose that extra money. If you're cheating financially, you get upstairs, that's one of the first things they ask you when you're honest in business. If you're cheating, you're showing God, I don't believe in you. I don't trust you. I know you told me that I'm going to have this extra bounty. I know you told me you're going to, you know, take care of me, but I don't know about that. I'm going to squirrel away some extra food in the silo. So you can't at the same time, if you don't believe in God's miracles, when he's not going to do them for you. He's only going to do them for you and do extra for you if you believe that he's going to do extra for you. So you have to be so careful that it's a haunting question. What will I eat in the 7th year? Is a question that every single one of us asks every day at work when we face some kind of temptation, do something illegal or unethical or not so clear gray area that it's okay. And every time that we prepare and sign our tax return. I remember once when I first moved to Passaic, Rabbi Sachs in Passaic went through a shir and went through every possible excuse that people give that they claim that this rabbi said you could possibly cheat on your taxes. And he eviscerated every single one of them. And then we got to the end, he said, and remember, you have to sign your name to that at the end. And if you sign your name and it's not true, you're signing your name to a lie. And I'm pretty comfortable telling you that God does not want us to sign our name to a lie. And there are times when it's so open and obvious that God is like peeking out. You know, sometimes the miracles are just in the timing. Like when we say miracle, we're thinking of the car that falls off the mountain, hits the tree and bounces upside down, and the airbags go off. You know, a fellow just told me, I got a call just last week from a person who said to me, he goes, you know, I heard one of your stories. He goes, you're not going to believe it. He goes, I had one like that that happened to me. I said, what happened? So he sends me the picture of what his car looked like after the accident. Someone ran a red light. I'm saying car. It was half a car. Car was demolished. The only injury he had was that he had a possible fractured rib after the airbags went off and he got hit based on where he got hit, either the airbag or the initial hit, possible fractured rib. You would not believe if you saw it. I've seen cars like this where people either don't get out or they get out and they have, you know, 12 surgeries or in the hospital for a year. I said, how in the world did you get out of that? He goes, you're not going to believe the story. He says, I started doing executive security. So he protects executives, you know, who are, I guess, I don't know, high net worth individuals who are worried about attacks, et cetera. So he says, that night I got a gig that started at midnight. So when I went to get the, you know, they give me equipment, they gave me a bulletproof vest. It was the first time that I'm wearing a bulletproof vest. He says, so I put it on at 6 o'clock and the guy who gave it to me, he's like, what are you doing? It's 90 degrees. And he said, I know, but I look so cool in it. He says, I got into my car and I kept it on. The dude was given a bulletproof vest at 6 o'clock, put it on, and at 6:45, he was in a massive car accident and saved him. Like, it's just, you know, sometimes it's all in the timing. I'll give you another example, which is that I was leading a trip 2 years ago for a group called Momentum. You may be familiar with them. Lori Palatnik started an organization that has brought thousands of women on women's trips and men on men's trips to Israel. And one of the fellows on my trip, I found out on the first day there, was a father of one of the victims in the Parkland slaying. Like, unbelievably difficult. The Parkland slaying in school. He had gotten a call from school that his 17-year-old son had been gunned down by a lunatic in the school in February. And this trip was in October. So it was still very, very raw. I'm sure for the rest of his life, it'll be very, very raw. For example, when he told somebody who told me, it wasn't that I didn't take a look at it. When I took the guys to the Kotel and gave out pieces of paper and pens and gave a talk about prayer and explained how, you know, it's very common tradition. If you'd like, you can, you know, make a request and write it down and fold up the piece of paper and stick it on the wall. He wrote one question down on a piece of paper and he stuck it on the wall. His question was, why did this happen? And I spend time speaking to him to the extent that I can. And then obviously I've been through it, you know, very often with clients, but extraordinarily difficult. So he started an organization that is, its mission is to reduce the chances and the possibility of child-on-child violence in schools. And he's made a lot of headway. And because it was a new organization, he was looking to do lobbying in Congress. So Friday night, we're at the Kotel, and I get a tap on the shoulder, and I turn around, and it's my old buddy, Rabbi Levi Shem Tov. Rabbi Levi Shem Tov runs the Chabad embassy in Washington. You'll laugh. I call it an embassy because Chabad, Lubavitch, they actually bought one of the homes that used to be an old embassy. And they're on Embassy Row. They're there in between France and the Netherlands, you know, as Chabad. Since Levi's a childhood friend. We were classmates in school in Philadelphia growing up. So Levi said to me, listen, you know, I said, I'm so sorry. I knew he was in Israel because he was marrying off a child. He had invited me to the wedding. I said, I'm so sorry. We got back too late last night. That night, I'm sorry I couldn't make it. He said, listen, where are you eating your meal? I said, oh, we're eating up in the H building in the old city. He said, okay, I'm also in the old city for Sheva Brachas. You know, remember the address. Here's the address. You know, when you're finished your meal and you're on your way back to the hotel, stop by for the Sheva Brachas. I said, great. Okay, fine. So for whatever reason, Levi came in on his way up to the Sheva Brachas and he stopped in to say hello to me again, brought his wife over to introduce me. And then he went to say hello to Lori Palatnik, who runs the organization because he knows her from DC. And then he said goodbye, reminded me the address, and he left. So Lori, while he was still in the room, says, I want everybody to know we have a celebrity sighting here. Everybody wave hi to Rabbi Levi Shem Tov. He's the Chabad Shaliach, the Chabad emissary of the Chabad embassy in Washington. Anybody who needs anything in Washington should go see Levi. So he leaves. A few minutes later, this fellow, his name's Max, comes over to me and says, Harry, the rabbi that Lori mentioned in Washington, I realized I want you to introduce me to him. She said he knows everybody in Washington. I said, he does. He said, I want to see if he can help me with lobbying with my organization. Is he still here? I said, no, he just left. He said, you're going to see him again. I said, as a matter of fact, I am supposed to stop by after dinner. I said, when we finish dinner, come over to me and we'll stop by and I'll introduce you real quick. So fine. Dinner ends. He comes over to me and we walk by. Now I want to do the following. I want to get in to that Sheva Brachas and get out as quickly as possible because the guys are waiting for me back at the hotel. So I want to go in. I want to say Mazel Tov. I didn't want to sit down. I want to introduce Max to Levi, Levi to Max, explain to Levi what happened to Max's son and that he's doing lobbying and that could he, you know, follow up with you. We walk in and there was a woman who was in the middle of a story and right away they pull out chairs for us in the center of the table and sit us down. And I can tell right away, A, she's at the beginning of the story, and B, the story is never going to end. It's just one of those stories. I can tell right away. I can't believe this. But in the meantime, I'm there. So I'm listening to the story. And she's telling this crazy story about a soldier. And he was friendly with a young boy, an Israeli soldier. And then he lost his arm in the war. And he came back and the boy had died. I think to myself, like, I wanted to wave her. Like, lady, is this Sheva Brachas? What kind of – who tells a story like that? Is Sheva Brachas? Where are you going with this? Okay. So she's going on and on. And finally, and years later, the soldier came to America and someone said to him, you know, you really need to meet the Rebbe. So he took him to meet the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the Rebbe said to him, like, explained to him about his arm with tefillin, et cetera. He gave him some – he said, but I know what's been bothering all these years. What's been bothering you is the loss of that young boy with whom you were friendly. And you want to know, why did God take the life of that young boy? And I'm sitting there going, I can't believe this. Here you got Max, who spent a week stuck in note in the hotel not 2 nights ago saying, God, why? And now he's about to hear the Rebbe's answer for why another young boy. I can't believe, you can't make this stuff up. So she proceeds to say, and the Rebbe said to him, that every soul has a mission here in life. And some souls, they complete their mission early. And when they complete their mission, they are whisked right up to heaven. I literally can't believe this happened. So I turn to Levi. She finishes. I turn to Levi and I whisper, you're not going to believe this. The guy next to me, Max, who I brought along, he lost his son in a Parkland slang. I came here to introduce him to you because he started an organization. He's lobbying, so I wanted to meet you. I said, I can't believe she just told that story. The guy all week has been trying to figure out why. This is mind blowing. So Levi gets up immediately after me to speak, and he's a pros pro. He says his, you know, wonderful messages to the Chassan and the Kala, and he has the Dvar Torah, and then he says, I want to tell you the following. And he says, I want to introduce you. Here is my longtime childhood friend, Harry Rothenberg. He's leading a trip for men from across the world. And he brought over, he wanted me to meet his friend Max. And Max, unfortunately, it pains me to say it, one of his sons was one of the victims in the Parkland slang. And Max has spent the week and he wanted the answer. Why did this happen? He says, and I want to tell so-and-so. And he points to the woman. He said, I don't know why you thought you were telling this story, but I want to tell you now. The reason you were telling that story is so that Max could hear the Rebbe's answer. Okay, I'm just like, this is unbelievable. And I see that Levi is leaning over because the Chassan, his son, is pulling on his shoulder. So he leans in. He's like, He gets back up. He says, we have a rule that during the week of the wedding, Chassan Doma Lamelech, a groom is compared to a king. And when a king asks you to do something, you have to do it. So my son is just very taken with the story I just told about Max. So he's asking everyone at the Sheva Brachas, there must have been about 40 people there at the Sheva Brachas, he's asking everyone to please take on an extra mitzvah for the sake of elevating the soul of Max's son. Wow. Now at this point, my head is going to explode, okay? So I introduce Max to Levi and they say they'll be in touch. Fine. We walk out. And Max, the second we get outside, Max turns to me and goes, how'd you do that? I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, how'd you orchestrate that? I was like, Max, how can I possibly orchestrate that? You came over to me. I didn't know you were going to come over to me. We walked in together. I don't know that woman. She's from the other side. I didn't tell Levi anything. I didn't know. I didn't orchestrate it. He did. You know, it was one of those times where God was like saying, you know, like I play with my grandkids. You know, it was like, peekaboo, here I am. You know, sometimes the miracle is in the timing. It's not always a miracle because, you know, the sea split. And God made a, you know, a 90-year-old woman have a baby. And even in the sea splitting, I remember years ago, I think it was the New York Times, probably New York Times, maybe it was another newspaper that did this whole article around Pesach time where they were quoting scientists and they were explaining how there was a scientific explanation for each one of the plagues. So they were miracles. It was possible that this particular thing happened, that it would have caused a fissure, and that's how the sea split. You know, I remember saying like, yeah, but even if there was a scientific explanation, it split when the Jews were right in front of it, when the Egyptians were right behind them, their army, and the Jews walked through, and then they just happened to come back together when the Egyptians were in the sea. How do you like that, science? Wow, what an amazing coincidence in science pulled off. Sometimes the miracle is in the timing, and that's what we have to, and that's what we have to recognize. I'll finish with one more story. I had a case not long ago, last year, and very tragic case. A fellow had lost his wife in an automobile accident, and very difficult liability. Some was straightforward, but there were a number of different defendants. It involved the defendant was driving while well under the influence. And so we also brought in people who had served him and the person who owned the place we reserved. So there was some liability was very clear and some was much, much more tenuous. And so along the way, with some of the defendants, they had told me the entire time we're litigating, we're never going to pay you, we're never going to pay you, we're never going to pay you. Suddenly we had a firm trial date. It turned into maybe we'll pay you. And so we started negotiating. And when we got up to around $750,000, I started explaining to the client, listen, no amount of money is going to be enough, but I'm just telling you that as I get more, like if I get close to that magic $1 million number, I can't let you try the case. It's just too risky. As frankly, the judge may throw it out. I don't even know if we'll get to a jury. You know, the type of number that we'd be talking about, I don't know that I'll be able to, but if I can get them, push them up to that kind of number, it's an unheard of number for that type of liability. You got to take it. So we finally, in the last conversations, this is days before trial. Trial was supposed to start on Monday. So that Thursday afternoon, they finally come to it in the aggregate, $1 million. And I call the client. I tell them, I said, listen, you know, I'm going to go over with you, but this isn't just my recommendation. You have got to take this money. So he says, okay, I'm going to sleep, think about it tonight. Calls me the next morning. He says, okay. He says, I spoke to God and God told me not to take the money. I should continue to go forward. I said, I was in on that phone call. Maybe I could, you know, be in on that. I said, I think maybe you're hearing it a little wrong. I think maybe God's telling you, you know, you should, you know, not risk it and you should grab the money. He said, look, do you believe in God? I said, of course I believe in God. He said, I want to just explain to you that when I lost my wife, the only thing I had left was God. And I put all of my faith in him. And I'm telling you that I trust him and I feel that he's telling me that I should say no. And I said, look, I'm telling you that I'm a big believer in God, that he's telling you don't do something foolish. And he would not give in. God said to him. So we went to trial. And when we show up at trial, the judge says, what's going on? And I explained to the judge what's going on, that we've reached a number that the defendants say it's their last possible number. And I can't tell you in good conscience that I don't think it's a good number, but my client is a devout Christian, and he believes that God has told him that he should go forward, that it's you know, worth more, and a jury's going to give him more. So the judge said to me privately, look, I see this case, and I see these facts, and I see this number. I don't believe for a second that a jury is going to give you more. I don't know that it's going to get past me, but let me see what I can do. And after a whole lot of back and forth and back and forth, he ended up cobbling together an extra $100,000. So I called the client back and I said, look, I got to admit, okay, you're right. But now at this point in time, now you got to take the money. So he went, and I don't know what phone he used to get back in touch with God, but he eventually said yes. So he got an extra. Now I'm telling him, with years and years, I've been doing this a long time, 25 years or so. And I'm telling him, I can't get you another dollar and you can't be foolish. And he's telling me, I believe that God's telling me. And from his perspective, he just felt that, you know, he was believing in God and God ended up giving him more. And it was interesting. I spoke to Rabbi Becher about this, Mordechai Becher, with whom I learned. And he said, it's very interesting. If you look carefully, there's some debate about this, but there are those who say that everybody agrees that the more you believe in God, the more you get. And in some commentators, it does not distinguish Jewish versus non-Jewish. So for me, you can just imagine like I'm a guy wearing a yarmulke and I have a client say to me, do you believe in God? Like, come on, dude, you want to feel this thing with me? Do I believe in God? And he's saying, well, maybe, you know, my belief is even stronger than yours because I put all my faith in him. You can give me all your legal mumbo jumbo. But it was just, it was a stunning lesson in that there's always another level to go to. And the more you believe, the more you get. If you trust in God, he will always be there. If you believe that he is ready, willing, and able to do not just massive miracles for the world, but individual miracles just for you, sometimes upending nature, sometimes working things out where it's so obvious with respect to the timing that he's there orchestrating all of the events. And so the more we believe, the more we get back. Thank you very much for listening. As Phil mentioned at the outset, and I appreciate the plug, if you enjoyed this, I do a short weekly video. It's much shorter. It's 3 or 4 minutes long. You can find it on YouTube. You can search Harry's video blog, or you can find it on the Orson Mack website. And thank you very much for listening.
Wow.